libertarians favor an aggressive, what you'd even might call an activist judiciary, one that's willing to strike down misguided precedent, overturn unconstitutional laws. Conservatives embrace judicial restraint, which is the idea that the court should be deferring to the will of legislative majorities, deferring to the courts and upholding laws.
Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie for Reason TV. Today we're talking with Damon Root, author of the great July cover story in Reason, Conservatives versus Libertarians, The Debate Over Judicial Activism Divides Former Allies. Damon, thanks for talking to us. What's the main beef of your story?
Basically, it's about a profound division within the conservative legal movement between libertarians and conservatives over what the proper role of the court should be. So libertarians favor an aggressive, what you'd even might call an activist judiciary, one that's willing to strike down misguided precedent, overturn unconstitutional laws. Conservatives embrace judicial restraint, which is the idea that the court should be deferring to the will of legislative majorities, deferring to the courts and upholding laws. And libertarians, of course, believe that the courts should be a check against the tyranny of the majority. Conservatives embrace this majority.
Who are the major players on the Supreme Court right now who best embody this tension?
I think it's best embodied between Justices Thomas and Scalia. And, of course, these justices are all of two minds on these things. They're drawing from both traditions.
What's a paradigmatic example of Clarence Thomas being, you know, a hardcore libertarian legal theorist?
Well, just this very week, we had the Second Amendment case, 14th Amendment case, McDonald versus Chicago, where it's Justice Thomas who followed what was the libertarian argument, which was that to apply the Second Amendment to the states, you do that through the Privileges or Immunities Clause of the 14th Amendment. Justice Scalia, basically, who's billed himself as this great originalist, you should be following the text of the Constitution, he basically ignores the text and history of the Constitution of the 14th Amendment. And Justice Thomas is the one who takes what we could call the libertarian line.
Right. And Scalia, then, is the kind of the conservative heavyweight on the court. What's another example where he said, you know what, even if this does violate somebody's liberty, we should go with the with the precedents that are in place?
Well, in 5 years ago, in the medical marijuana case, Gonzalez v. Raich, this is a case that turns on what is the commerce power of the federal government or Congress to regulate under the Commerce Clause. And Scalia had been this great critic of an expansive reading of the Commerce Clause, but then in this case, maybe because it has to do with medical marijuana or illegal drugs, something that maybe he's uncomfortable with, he suddenly starts pulling back from what had been a more principled position.
And that's also, I believe it was Thomas who said, look, if the Commerce Clause is covering the potential for a state to legalize medical marijuana provided by nonprofit people, then the Commerce Clause covers everything, and we're living in a total tyranny.
He says that if this is, you know, if basically growing a plant in your backyard or your neighbor grows it and then you consume that plant on your property, it literally never leaves the state, doesn't leave your county. If that's interstate commerce, then anything is interstate commerce, and Congress can do anything it wants.
And, of course, Scalia was following a Depression-era ruling that basically said that about corn or about vegetable produce that was created for a farmer's own personal use.
Right. It was during the New Deal, Wickard versus Filburn, Roscoe Filburn, this farmer who's growing wheat on his own farm for his family's consumption and not to enter this stream of interstate commerce at all. And the court says, no, that affects the stream of interstate commerce, therefore we can regulate that. And that's the precedent that Scalia upholds.
What do you think is going to happen in terms of this conservative libertarian split or individual rights versus originalism or a deference to legislatures and precedent? What's going to happen?
I think that what we're seeing is a gradual increase of the libertarian argument, that more conservatives are starting to be selectively libertarian to favor a more aggressive judiciary on some issues, not on all.
And is that simply because the laws they're going to be dealing with have been put into place by Democrats or liberals?
There's absolutely a bit of whoever's in power. Yeah. Suddenly when you're out of power, you want the courts to strike down laws, and then when you're in power, you want the courts to uphold them. I think there's definitely some of that going on. But there's also, I think, been an intellectual triumph of the principled activist case that libertarians libertarians have been making, and they've been attacking particularly Judge Robert Bork, who I argue in the article is the most influential conservative thinker and the biggest advocate of this majoritarian restraint.
You know, they should basically, the majority should be able to pass whatever laws they want.
Right. In his book, The Tempting of America, he writes that in wide areas of life, majorities are entitled to rule if they wish simply because they're majorities. He calls that the first principle of the American system. So unlike libertarians who would say the first principle is individual rights or liberty, Bork says it's majority rule.
How do liberals interface with that? Because, you can see certainly in the past they were, they're the reason Bork didn't make it to the Supreme Court. But do they actually find a lot to dig into in terms of majoritarianism, especially if it destroys the bulwark against the state saying, hey, now we're going to start doing this?
I think that the liberals, well, it's interesting is this idea of judicial restraint and majoritarianism is a progressive era concept. So it's basically pioneered by Justice Louis Brandeis, Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes. And so Bork has essentially adopted what at one point was a progressive legal mindset, because the progressives, what they were concerned about were conservative judges striking down economic regulations,
right, saying that they did at some point during the New Deal.
Right.
And then they got whipped and they started giving it up.
And, right? And so what you see after the New Deal is the liberals who had been arguing for judicial restraint then start to say, well, but maybe we'd like the courts to enforce some rights for what they call us insular minorities. You see this gradual, well, then maybe it gets into privacy and abortion rights. So suddenly the liberal justices start to pull back a little from the restraint. They still say, let's defer to majorities when it comes to economic regulations, but when it comes to some rights that we value, then you should be a little more aggressive.
Are any of the liberal justices articulating explicitly Borkian notions of majority?
They're drawing from it. And Justice Stevens, particularly in the last, I'd say, year or so, has really started to use some of these. He's obviously not citing.
Yeah.
He may be citing. He's not citing Bork explicitly, but I mean, he's definitely drawing on some of those precedents that Bork would draw on, and has been accusing in the Citizens United case, in Heller, and in McDonald. Stevens accused the conservative majority of being judicial activists, basically throwing that charge at the right, and it's usually the right throwing that charge at the left.
Elena Kagan's about to get on the Supreme Court. How is she going to affect the makeup of the court and the types of rulings it's putting forth?
It's hard to tell because she's managed to give a lot of non-answers, as all these as all recent Supreme Court nominees do. I think it's very safe to say that she's going to be a pretty consistent liberal vote. Mm-hmm. So, as Solicitor General in the Citizens United case, Kagan argued on behalf of defended. The government's position was in defense of the McCain-Feingold law, and since that decision came down against her position, she said that she thought that the court should have deferred more to Congress. So I think what we'll see with her on the court, and as Barack Obama's policies are being challenged and brought to the challenge before the Supreme Court, you're going to see this liberal bloc saying, no, it's time to defer to Congress. It's time to practice some judicial restraint, judicial modesty. And we'll be using those arguments against the conservatives.
Final question. You've written a lot about kind of libertarian judicial activism, a lot of which has to do with overturning precedent. What's the one precedent, what's the one law that's going to come up around the Supreme Court or has recently that needs to be changed?
I do think that there's the challenge under the Commerce Clause to the Health Care Act is very strong. That's going to probably, if that comes before the court, that'll be in a few years. I think that's a very good example of where we shouldn't be deferring to Congress. The court should be looking and strictly scrutinizing the law in question. As far as recent Supreme Court precedents, I'd love to see the Kelo decision thrown out, the Gonzales Rage decision. I think those are horrible precedents, should be overturned.
Why is the Kelo decision so bad? I mean, we both agree that eminent domain abuse, first off, is abuse, but, it's not constitutional per se. But why does that rise to a level that where it's more execrable than everything Congress does on a daily basis?
Well, the Constitution says that private property can be taken for a public use with just compensation paid, and Kelo and some of the other eminent domain cases in the court's line have expanded public use to public purpose and civic purpose. So essentially, it's one thing to take land to build a road or a highway or a hospital or even a zoo or something that's something that the public is using. It's open to all. Now we're just seeing these takings for sports stadiums, basically for the purpose just of raising more tax money. Justice O'Connor's dissent in Kelo I thought was very good, where she said, under this standard, any farm can be taken and turned into a shopping mall, and a Hotel Six can be taken for a Ritz-Carlton. And so I think that's a very dangerous precedent.
Great. Thank you. I'm Nick Gillespie for Reason TV. We've been talking with Damon Root, Reason Associate Editor, about his cover story in the July issue of Reason, Conservatives versus Libertarians. Thanks, Damon.
Thank you.